The last few weeks have seen the release of two critically acclaimed movies, each exploring the career of a man who has entered popular mythology. David Fincher's The Social Network, which is in theaters everywhere, stars Jesse Eisenberg as Mark Zuckerberg, the creator of Facebook. Carlos, by the French director Olivier Assayas, is a 5.5-hour saga about the notorious 70s terrorist Carlos the Jackal. It's currently in selected theaters and available on demand through most cable companies. Our critic at large, John Power, says that seeing them side by side got him thinking about how much social values have changed over recent decades.
If you'd been born 1,000 years ago, or even 300, you would have lived your whole life in a society whose values were essentially those of your great-great-great-grandparents. These days, however, history moves at a dizzying speed. Ideas I once took for granted now seem as long gone as getting a telegram. The depth of this cultural change struck me as I was watching two of the year's most interesting films. Carlos, Olivier Assayas's historical thriller about the 70s terrorist Carlos the Jackal, and David Fincher's breezy The Social Network, which centers on Mark Zuckerberg, the Harvard undergrad behind Facebook. While their stories could hardly sound more different, the movies have striking similarities, and not only because the filmmakers freely admit to fictionalizing things. Both Carlos and Zuckerberg are young anti-heroes who remain ciphers. Both are narcissistic outsiders who profess idealism while behaving unidealistically. And above all, both embody key fantasies of the very different eras in which they became famous. Beginning in 1972, Carlos charts the violent rise and seedy fall of Caracas-born Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, who dubbed himself Carlos, a charismatic political gangster played with great animal cunning by Edgar Ramirez. Whether working with Marxist Palestinians or the East German secret police, Carlos styled himself a revolutionary, and he went about his work with sociopathic ruthlessness. He murdered cops, blew up cafes and trains, and in a spectacular 1975 coup that the film captures brilliantly, he kidnapped the OPEC ministers in Vienna and ferried them by jet to Algiers. It's an amazing story and one told with gripping lucidity. Here, early on, Carlos offers his services to a leader from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
Arafat is the traitor. He is ready to make any kind of compromise. Our organization serves the Palestinian revolution. The cowards that betrayed are our enemies.
I live in London. I can be very useful there. Mohamed Moudia, who headed operations in Europe, was executed by Israeli agents from the Mossad. I believe I can replace him.
You are still a boy. I need men.
So you don't trust me because I'm young?
You have to prove yourself. We will give you a mission.
What mission?
Andre will tell you. Andre is a fighter I've chosen as the Moudia successor. He's in Paris now. He will contact you.
When?
In time.
Despite his big words, Carlos had all the principles of a barracuda. He was basically in it for himself. But his gaudy crimes touched something in the zeitgeist, and the media conspired to dress him in an aura of rock star cool. You see, this was an age that still believed in liberation movements, an age in which countless millions, many of them young, dreamed that the world could be saved by political revolution. Back then, the idea that Barack Obama is a communist would have had even Ronald Reagan laughing. Be that as it may, Assayas makes it clear that Carlos never came close to liberating anybody. Utterly without a mass following, his supposedly revolutionary violence actually did very little, except discredit the left. Far from advancing a cause, Carlos's adventurism merely popularized a tactic. He's one of the founding fathers of today's globalized terrorism. The Social Network's Mark Zuckerberg is also a founding father. But man, have times changed. Where 40 years ago such a brainy young misfit might have been drawn to left-wing politics, that idea seems almost absurd in today's America, even at liberal Harvard. Despite the financial crisis, our culture still celebrates the values of a go-go capitalism in which Warren Buffett is treated as a seer, and you're more likely to overhear conversation about a new iPhone app than about the war in Afghanistan. In keeping with the spirit of the age, Zuckerberg's fantasy isn't toppling the system, it's being successful within it. More attuned to code than ideas, he not only invents Facebook in 2004, but he fights to retain control of it, a process that includes turning friends into foes, waging battles in court, and insulting anybody he thinks dumber than he is, meaning everybody. Along the way, he makes himself the youngest billionaire in history and influences the daily lives of Facebook's 500 million users. If Carlos was the terrorist as rock star, Zuckerberg is a nerd messiah, an uncool guy who, sitting in his dorm room, has changed how we live to an extent that the globe-trotting radical Carlos could only dream of. Not that this makes him happy, at least according to The Social Network, which views Zuckerberg's entrepreneurial ascent as coolly as Assayas does Carlos's terrorism. The movie ends with the young tycoon, hugely successful and wealthy. Not a nice guy, but one of the kings of our culture. In his triumph, he seems a far cry from Carlos, who, by the time he's finally caught and imprisoned, has sunk into debauchery and irrelevance. Of course, if the jackal were a more generous soul, he might consider friending Zuckerberg, just to give him an avuncular heads up on how quickly, in our hyper-fast modern world, a man's historical moment can fade away.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
And it used to be that if you had a good cable subscription, you were covered for TV, if both of you wanted to watch it. Now some people are buying Roku boxes, renting movies on Apple TV, and streaming Netflix through their Wii. And the biggest name on the internet has just put its hat into the ring. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on Google TV.
There have been TVs on the market that sort of, well, kind of, connect you to the internet. Nettie Puente, a salesperson at Best Buy in San Francisco, shows off a typical set.
This is the Samsung one. There's going to be a little button on all your remotes. So you hit Internet TV, and it's going to take you straight to your applications.
The key word here is applications. The set has internet connections to Netflix, Yahoo, Pandora, Amazon, but you can't watch all the video you find on the web. That's true of Apple TV and the Roku box, too. That's what makes Google TV different.
We are trying to bring the whole web.
Rishi Chandra is part of the team that developed Google TV.
What Google TV really offers is a way for you to seamlessly access all that great web content that is already out there today that you access on your PC or your mobile phone directly on your television.
To get Google TV, you have to buy a special Sony TV or one of their Blu-ray players or a box built by Logitech. Chandra is using the Logitech box, which comes with a lightweight keyboard that controls the TV.
What you'll see here is I'm going to bring down a search box. Anyone who understands the web understands this notion of being able to type in where you want to go, and we'll help you get there.
Chandra searches for the spoof news site, The Onion.
The Onion actually has a great set of video content online.
Just ahead, the Huffington Post has launched a new print edition featuring articles torn out of other newspapers.
This is The Onion, and you can see I can, you know, as part of the personalization aspect, right, I can actually go and, you know, watch the episodes or the videos that I care about.
And you don't have to sit in your desk chair in front of your computer screen. You can lie on the couch surrounded by your friends and watch it on a big TV. When Quentin DeWolf settles into his couch to watch his Google TV, he says he moves effortlessly between cable and the internet.
50% of the time, it's watching regular plain Jane TV, and I do use its guide to find TV shows. And then 50% of the time, I'm going to sites and watching video on those sites.
DeWolf says it's perfect for him because there is just some programming he can't get through his cable provider.
I'm a strange bird who's into a lot of things that the mainstream American are not. I like things like anime and also European cars and all these things that there are lots of shows about in the rest of the world, but there aren't in this country.
But he isn't ready to turn off his cable connection yet, because there is a lot of regular TV he can't get online. And there's a reason for that. There are a lot of companies with an interest in how you watch the internet on your TV. Cable companies, networks, movie studios, Netflix, Apple, Amazon, the list is long. The minute Google stepped into the TV world, it had a conflict with the major networks. When you are on your computer and you go to the ABC site, you can watch entire episodes of Dancing with the Stars.
So let's wait no more. For the first time this season, let's bring out our brand new stars.
But when you try it with Google TV, ABC has blocked the site. The same is true for NBC and CBS. The problem for the network, says Gartner analyst Andrew Frank, is that they can't make as much money off the web broadcasts. The cable companies pay tens of millions of dollars a year for access.
That's what I think they believe is under threat from this so-called over-the-top model that connected TVs represent.
Frank says Google TV has also got the cable companies worried.
The big fear for cable companies is that consumers are going to start realizing that they can get a lot of this content online for free or pay less, and they're going to start cutting the cord, as they say.
But Frank thinks one thing that might happen is that the cable companies will raise their rates for internet connections as consumers start canceling their cable subscriptions. And Frank thinks, inevitably, they will. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from member station WDET and NPR News. Coming up, an edition of our occasional feature, In Your Ear. Today, it's Detroit native, the soulful singer and songwriter, Kem. We'll have that for you in just a few minutes. But first, the city is known for producing cars and for creating hit music with the legendary Motown sound. But now the city is trying to transition into movie town. Hollywood has been lured to Detroit partly because of some generous tax incentives. But the city can also serve as an intriguing character in and of itself, as evidenced by the new ABC police drama Detroit 187. With me to talk more about this are two of the show's stars, Michael Imperioli and James McDaniel. You certainly know them from their previous award-winning television lives on The Sopranos and NYPD Blue. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us on your day off. You both look a little tired, actually. You're working hard.
I feel pretty good.
I'm good.
All right. Well, thank you. So I understand that the series was first originally shot in part in Atlanta, but later moved on location to Detroit. And Mr. McDaniel, I understand that you played a role in that. You were a strong advocate for doing that.
Yeah, I was, when I say advocate, it's not like I can twist anybody's arm. It was more putting it in the guy's ears that I would really like to go to ground zero. I'd like to go to where this show would really live with no hopes of it actually happening. I thought it was a pipe dream because it's never happened before. So, I was a cheerleader for that.
Why? Because it had never happened before?
No, because, you know, you want to go as an artist to where the action actually is. You know, this backdrop of this city is just absolutely stunning and incredible. You can't get this in Los Angeles, New York. You just can't get it. And I like the authenticity of being here. I like the feel of being here. Little did I know that I would love the people and just the environment.
And Michael Imperioli, it's nice to see you back on the right side of the law.
Thank
of course,
you.
People will remember you from The Sopranos.
All right.
I want to talk a little bit about your character in Detroit 187. And 187, where is that? What is that?
Police code for homicide.
Is it used in Detroit, actually?
I thought it was a
California code.
I think it is, but the writer felt it sounded cool.
It sounded cool. Well, yeah. I must say that initially, some of the initial feedback from some of the Detroit television writers that I talked to said, is a little too New York. What's up? Apparently one of the characters asked for a slice, which is a pizza, which is a New York thing. There was some unhappiness. There was a request for soda, not pop. Presumably you're fixing some of those
tweets.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, my character's from New York, so I don't worry about those things.
Because you would want a slice, right?
Exactly.
Let's talk about your character, Lewis Fitch, Detective Fitch, very dedicated to his job, not very interested in people rooting around in his personal life. I just want to play a short clip from an exchange between you and your rookie partner on the program. They get into it over your partner touching a paperweight on your desk. Here it is.
Did you touch my scorpion?
No.
Well, somebody did. When I left, the stinger was pointing north, and now it's the other way.
Fine, I picked it up.
Why would you do that?
Look at your desk. You got a computer and a phone, not a single personal artifact. Then that thing appears. How am I not going to pick it up?
You control yourself like a grown man.
Come on.
If you touch anything on my desk, I will chop off your hands. I'll lock them in the gun safe.
Roger that.
Okay, well, I won't be touching anything on your desk. I'll just point taken. So tell me about the character. Why were you drawn to it?
He's, like you said, he's very dedicated. He's very, very good at his job. He has one of the highest rates of solving murders in Detroit. There was a scene in the pilot where he does an interrogation and he basically just sits very still and stares at this very suspect who's really posturing, trying to be this very tough, hard street guy. And Fitch just stares at him for a really long period of time. And the guy goes through a lot of different emotions and eventually kind of starts telling him about his life story and confessing. And that scene just, I thought, that's very creative, you know. I mean, both from a writer's point of view, but from a character point of view, and from a person's point of view, too. There was something about his center of gravity that I felt was very kind of peaceful yet severe at the same time.
How is it for you working in Detroit? What's the experience been like for you?
For me, it's been, as an actor, it really helps. I think there's a sense of osmosis that happens between a location and the project itself. It's like The Sopranos, if that was shot on a studio back lot in L.A., it never would have been what it was. I mean, the fact that we shot some of the locations and were built in studios, interior stuff, but most of it was on location in New Jersey. And being on location here in Detroit, you really get a sense of the life of the city and the lives of the people and what they go through on a day-to-day basis and what it's like. And I think that really has a very positive impact on the work.
James McDonald, I want to ask about the whole question of shooting a crime drama here in a city, which, of course, experiences crime. But there are those who feel that Detroit's taken enough hits in the national consciousness and worry that a lot of people are loving it. I've been reading the message boards and listening to the comments that people are making. People are saying, I love looking at the landmarks. It makes me feel at home. I like telling people about this place or that place. But there is that sort of lingering fear. Do we really need something that talks about murder in a city that's already taken a lot of hits? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I'll give you one of my little secrets. For my character and for me, James McDaniel, it's not a detective story. It's a story about people living their lives with very, very high stakes. And when you have high stakes, strange things happen. And sometimes it's like watching a car wreck or something like that. You really want to stop and look because people are stressed. And that's when the worst and the best comes out of people. And to me, when I show up at the crime scene, it's not procedural in my mind at all. It's about what happened to these people and what's going to happen to the survivors and things like that. The backdrop, this could be a fireman show, I could be a cowboy, I could be a lot of different things.
I'll play a short clip of you, if you don't mind. You are Sergeant Jesse Longford, and in this scene you're speaking to the character played by Aisha Hines, and in this exchange you're expressing some pleasure in having to tell this big-time defense attorney that his son may have been the victim of foul play. Here it is. Mm-hmm.
There's our John Doe.
Any relation to the defense attorney, Leon Edmondson?
His son.
His father's a bit of a blowhard, right?
With a very high acquittal rate.
Yeah, if we bust him, he gets him off.
That attitude, it's not going to get in the way now, will it?
Man just lost his son. I think I can table my feelings for a death notification.
All right. Let's get to it.
Yo que Dios vole lo cuadro. What God wills, I will. Yo que Dios vole lo cuadro.
Honestly, 24/7. I swear, 24/7.
Nice accent, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I was criticizing it while I was listening.
I saw that. But can I ask how you are? You've played many roles. Many people have seen you in Malcolm X and in other things. But of course, NYPD Blue is a role that many people identify with you. You played Lieutenant Arthur Fancy. Any concern about taking on another? I know you said this is not a detective story. It's a human story. But taking on another police role and being typecast. And what are you doing to switch it up, make it its own thing?
I don't see much of a comparison between the two characters. And then the other thing is that you have to take into account how many years ago was that? I don't know. But, you know, I've done 30 things since then, you know. that was just, it may be something that a lot of people know me from, but it's just, that was just another character in my canon of work, you know. And, you know, don't forget, you know, I'm always on the stage, you know, I'm doing movies, I'm doing other TV shows and stuff. It's just, that was just one of the guys.
So you don't go off on your private time and try to arrest people, you know, it's not imprinted in your consciousness that
yes,
way.
I do. And after this interview, you will be locked up.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, I'll see. But, you know, my husband's a defense lawyer, so maybe I think I might be able to get a little help with that. I might be able to survive the experience. So Michael Imperioli, tell me a little bit more about as we said, that the message boards, people are starting to really enjoy the experience of both watching you, of course, you've got your fans, and getting into Detroit and seeing Detroit on the big screen. Can you just give us a little bit of a hint of where you want to take the series next, your character next? Give us some hints.
Well, the show has been getting more and more into the personal lives of the detectives, which I'm really happy about, you know. I mean, we do have our crimes of the week, but it's not really a procedural show. It's not just about solving crimes and the methods used to solving crimes. And I think the more we go on, we're going to see more of these characters' personal lives. And that, to me, is golden, you know. I mean, I don't find procedural stuff, to be honest, very interesting. I think I like human interaction and human drama and revelations about people's characters and relating to people that way. And I think you're going to see more of that, more of the history. I mean, very little is known about Fitch's backstory, but we're going to start to uncover more of that as we go on. And I think for the rest of the characters as well. And I'm really happy about that.
Can I ask you a little bit about that whole question of representation and how places are portrayed in the world? As you of course, remember that some people were uncomfortable with The Sopranos because they felt, gee, Italian-Americans, they've had enough too.
Right.
They've had enough being portrayed as mobsters and,
right,
you know, enough of that. Could we get a president maybe, please, or something like that? Did you ever feel any of that when you were with The Sopranos? And do you have
no,
any
I didn't
relate?
Feel
do you
that.
Relate to that
I felt
concern
it was
now?
An unfair criticism. I felt like It was a show about mafia people. So if anyone had a right to complain, it was the mafia. You know, it wasn't meant to represent.
You know, I didn't think to ask about their opinion. I'm sorry.
And for the
I
most
that.
Part, they really liked it, from what I heard. But it wasn't a show that was meant to represent the entire Italian American experience. Nor do I think it is fair to every time you do something to shoulder the responsibility of a whole group of people. It's a work. It's a work of art. I mean, it really is. It's not politics. And it's not meant to be. And if some people get their feathers ruffled, I think that's okay. You know, they have a right to say whatever they want. But I think we, as artists, have a right to portray what we want. As far as police, I've done a lot of research. I've played several detectives, and I've done a lot of research both in New York and here in Detroit for this job. And I have a great deal of respect for what they do. I think it's an extremely difficult job and an unselfish job. And I will bring that into my portrayal, but obviously you're going to sometimes show not so great colors to these people, and that's okay too, because it's, you know, the world is not perfect.
Michael Imperioli plays Detective Louis Fitch in the new drama, the ABC drama Detroit 187, which airs on ABC on Tuesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. He was here with us at the studios of WDET in Detroit, along with James McDaniel, who plays Sergeant Jesse Longford, and they were both kind enough to take some time from their very busy schedule of filming to join us here. And thank you so much for speaking with us. Good luck to you both. And please
thank
don't
you.
Arrest me later.
Thanks
please.
For having us. No, you're
we'll think
under
about
arrest
it.
Now.
A mysterious phenomenon around this time of year seems to affect television ratings, and with them a lot of broadcast revenue. On Sunday, we'll turn our clock back an hour and go off daylight saving time. According to TV industry lore, this seems to have a big effect on how many people watch television. NPR's Netta Ulaby investigates.
It's true, says Bill Gorman. He helps run a website called TV by the Numbers.
We headlined a post last spring, Networks Fear the Sun.
Last spring was when American Idol hit a historic ratings low, right after daylight saving time started. Suddenly it's light outside for an extra hour. Watching TV is less appealing.
Nice to have you with us.
Now, Idol had been hemorrhaging viewers pretty steadily, but it was not alone. Following daylight saving, the shows House and Chuck both dropped 17% in ratings from the week before, among adults aged 18 to 49. Not every show suffered a ratings dip, but Gorman says the trend generally held.
We saw last season about a 10 or 11% fall in the 8 p.m. hour, the Monday after daylight savings time came back.
And conversely, when we move our clocks back on Sunday, daylight saving may actually help TV ratings. Every year in early November, they jump. Bill Gorman of TV by the Numbers says that's probably partly due to local sweeps and special fall programming, but the chillier season's conducive to staying inside and cocooning.
I think television networks would like it to be dark as soon as you left the office and headed home for the night. And maybe it started raining or snowing a lot as soon as primetime began.
Come spring, TV network execs will be secretly singing this tune.
If I could turn back time.
Netta Ulaby, NPR
if
News.
If I could turn back time.
This is NPR News.